nearly 4 weeks ago now. On Tuesday, the 23rd of January, the President of the United States appeared on the media in order to announce that a ceasefire would go into effect in Vietnam. America breathed a collective sigh of relief. The longest, bitterest, most inexplicable war in our history seemed about to be behind us. The President said that night that he had gained that peace with honor which he had long sought, and that the United States had lived up to all those often made commitments to sustain the legitimate rights of the Vietnamese people. I doubt that most Americans really cared. It was enough that our troops would no longer be fighting. It was enough that our prisoners of war would soon be on their way home. I really doubt that too many Americans read the clauses of the contract which was signed that Saturday in Paris, or paid too much attention to the possible consequences of the suggested political solutions. We were quits. We were out of it. We should never have been in it. That was the simple equation for most of us. And yet I'm afraid that when we look carefully, if we do, at the Paris Agreement, we find that just as so much else that has surrounded the activities in Southeast Asia, it promises something to the meddlers and to the interlopers, to the great powers, and really promises very little, offers very little hope to the Vietnamese people themselves. There are two parts to the accord which was signed by Secretary of State Rogers and the Foreign Minister of North Vietnam, Le Duc Tho, and representatives of the Viet Cong and of the Thieu regime in Paris that Saturday. The first is purely military. There was to be a stand-pat ceasefire. The United States had not succeeded in what had patently been our stated purpose over the previous years, to allow the Saigon government to enjoy true sovereignty within some kind of definable and defensible border. One third of the land below the demilitarized zone, South Vietnam, according to this agreement, remains in the effective control under the armies of North Vietnam and of the Viet Cong. The 145,000 plus or minus North Vietnamese troops south of the demilitarized zone are to remain in place. And South Vietnam becomes really a crazy quilt pattern of conflicting and overlapping authorities. Whoever happens to have the guns on the spot is the sovereign, is the government, at least for the interim. We are to remove all of our troops, the 27,000 some odd troops, United States troops who remain in South Vietnam within 60 days. And we are to dismantle the bases which we have in South Vietnam within that same period of time. And all of our troops scattered over Indochina, as well as the Vietnamese troops, both north and south, which are scattered in Laos and Cambodia, are presumably to be removed within a similar period of time. There is to be an exchange of prisoners of war within this selfsame 60-day period, and there is to be movement towards the decriminalization of political prisoners who are now in the jails in Saigon. They're in a sense to be treated as prisoners of war and to be repatriated, presumably, to the side, to the government, which they espouse. And finally, the terms of the agreement are to be supervised by two commissions, one made up of the belligerent parties, Viet Cong, Saigon, Hanoi, and Washington, the other made up of so-called neutralist countries, Hungary, Poland, Indonesia, and Canada. So much for the political agreements. What do they provide for? They provide essentially the final possibility for the military disengagement of the United States from military activities in South Vietnam. Our 27,000 troops, all that remain after a four-year-long de-escalation from a peak of about 550,000 troops, will be removed. And during the first months after the signing of this agreement, which is obviously a sense and admission of defeat by the United States, during this winter of our discontent, we will receive back our prisoners of war, and we will be encouraged by moments of warm, homely reunion, by the vision of strong, sturdy men who did not break under imprisonment, who will remind us that there is still something right with the American character. This is the plus, as far as we are concerned. But when we turn to the political arrangements which are proposed, we find that they are ambiguous, unclear, that they give little direction to the future, and that they leave more problems unsolved than problems which are solved. The United States, according to the political arrangements, accepts the unity and the territorial integrity of Vietnam as it was first established by the Geneva Accords of 1954, which Secretary Dulles, as you remember, refused to accept. But at the same time, the demilitarized zone is to remain a provisional military demarcation line. The Saigon government is to remain in effective control of those territories which its army and its police now rule. But at the same time, there are to be, within a given period of time, a national election, a plebiscite, obviously with a view towards the reunification of the two Vietnams. Obviously, the unity of Vietnam is an assumption of this agreement, but at the same time, the North Vietnamese accept the proposition that the South Vietnamese have a right to self-determination. Where are we? Well, we are to see brought into being a National Committee on National Reconciliation and Comfort, which is to supervise this election. And this national committee is to be made up of the North Vietnamese, Viet Cong on the one hand, Saigon and its minions on the other, and a group which is called Neutralist. Who they are, where they will come from, how one finds after 50 years of war in Southeast Asia, truly neutral people, is again unclear. All that is certain is that those who drafted the documents recognized that they could not agree, that it was best to leave these issues obfuscated because it was a big power document. And the big powers could agree on one thing, that they wanted to disengage themselves from this conflict, particularly the United States, in order that we might complete what seems to be an emerging pattern of relationship between the big powers, though they will continue to jockey for economic advantage and political privilege. They are determined in this age of nuclear balance not to be manipulated into a direct military confrontation by their client states or client parties. The United States gained out. The Vietnamese people gained very little. For it is clearly evident that the North Vietnamese have assumed, and one can understand how, that the unification of Vietnam is simply a matter of time, and that that unification will take place under their general authority and suzerainty. But how long is a temporary division temporary? North Korea and South Korea have had a temporary division for over 20 years now. Is temporary a matter of 60 days, 6 months, 6 years, or 60 years? It's very clear that the North Vietnamese will do all in their power to bring about the reunification within a minimal period of time. And it's equally clear that Mr. Chu and the Saigon government intend to retain sovereignty, control over whatever they can control as if they are an independent state, that they have no intentions of submitting easily or willingly to the authorities of Vietnam. Now, the great powers have said that they will bring into being within 60 days an international commission to guarantee peace in Vietnam. And this international commission will consist not only of the parties to the conflict, but with all the parties of Southeast Asia, particularly the two great communist powers, the People's Republic of China and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. But what can this international commission really do? Very little, I suspect, except to guarantee that they will not interfere actively, militarily, in the squabbles of their clients. We will not see, I'm sure, Chinese soldiers or Russian soldiers. We haven't seen them yet in Vietnam, and I doubt that we will again see American soldiers in Vietnam. The great powers have obviously decided and the push and thrust, which continues and will continue, of international grab, greed. There are certain ground rules which they are unwilling now to go beyond. And the first one is this, that whether it's in Southeast Asia or in the Middle East or in Africa or in Latin America, it's too dangerous for there to be Soviet pilots in one set of aircraft and American pilots in the other set of aircraft. But on the ground itself, what has been achieved? Obviously, the Viet Cong and the Vietnamese will use the traditional Asian methods of political persuasion in order to gain victory in the plebiscite, assassination, terror, and the like. Obviously, the South Vietnamese will use traditional means of political pressure in that part of the world. Terrorism, assassination, political imprisonment, and the like. And obviously, incidents will escalate. And predictably, if there is finally an election, it will have a bloody prelude and it will have, I'm afraid, deadly consequences. For these people are committed to many parties and many points of view, and it's going to be very difficult for them, since each can still call upon the economic and military reserves of their patrons. It's going to be very difficult for any of them to give up and give in willingly. Vietnamese blood will be shed by Vietnamese. I suspect that is the tragedy of the next decade or two. But it will not be in the headlines. We'll not want to read about it. It will not directly threaten the peace of the world. It will threaten something of the balance of power between the great powers of the world. Why should China or Russia continue to sponsor the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong? Because Southeast Asia remains the great rice bowl of the world. And agricultural needs are obviously continuing needs of the Soviet and of China. Why else should they have to buy wheat from the hated West? And there is a long coastline, which will now be effectively and openly in friendly hands, from which they can ship out reserves or arms or economic aid to the Philippines, Malaysia, other places where they will seek now to move and to gain influence. Is it inevitable, really, that the United States continue to support various factions in Vietnam? Because obviously there is the coastline, and obviously there are the raw materials, and obviously we want to limit the ability of the great land powers of Asia to exert full influence over Thailand, Singapore, Malaysia, and the islands of the archipelagos. It's not a pretty picture that faces Vietnam. And perhaps that's the reason that America, though we sighed with relief at the announcement of the ceasefire, rang no bells and had no ticker tape parades. We recognize that even in the making of peace, we had not gained for ourselves any honor or respect as true peacemakers. What now? What's ahead for a post-Vietnam America? The bar has been high for the war in Vietnam. It's been high in terms of our manpower, nearly 50,000 dead. It's been high in terms of fiscal cost, in terms of the balance of trade, in terms of the monies that were poured into that morass, which could have been turned into hospitals and schools and recreation areas, the war on urban blight. The war has been tragic for America in terms of the tearing apart of the body politic. It turned thousands and tens of thousands of young Americans against their government. Young Americans not only opposed the policies of the government, but who were unwilling to put their lives down for those policies. And in time, as the war continued, it turned hundreds of thousands of middle Americans against their government, who felt that it was there was a blind kind of stupidity which was forcing us to prosecute a war which had been conceived in folly, and which all along during the period of pregnancy we had been told by all who were dispassionate that we were going to give birth to a monster. We'd had this war brought America to the brink of massive civil disobedience. This war will continue to cost Americans dearly. We must pay for the healing, the care of the veterans. There will obviously be bonuses and educational advantages and continuing hospitalization needs. And there are obviously secret arrangements between the parties that America will pay certain numbers of billions of dollars of reparations in order to make good the bombings. But I suspect that all Americans are glad that the pyramiding costs will really no longer pyramid. They can be factored out, they can be managed, they can be understood. We can get along to other business and other responsibilities. And I suspect, too, we breathe a sigh of relief from the single lesson which emerges from this war, and that is that the great powers are, for the moment, unwilling directly to confront each other, that really, apparently, the danger of a kind of global war has receded. That was the clear message of the negotiations. Americans, by and large, were surprised when the People's Republic of China and the USSR did not violently respond to the mining of the North Vietnamese coast or to the December bombings of the Haiphong Hanoi area. And I suspect that the other side is somewhat surprised at the willingness of the United States to sign an agreement that it will remove its troops not only from South Vietnam, but from all the rest of Indochina. But in both cases, the response is a signal to the other side that, for the nonce, no one feels strong enough, confident enough to risk a general war with another global power. What now? What now for an America which seems not to be threatened with a major international war, which can bring most of its troops home? What about a post-Vietnam America? I've been interested by the reactions that I hear as I talk here and there in this city and the country to the war, to its windup. Most Americans are prepared or seem prepared to accept Vietnam as a classic imperial blunder, as a military mistake, as diplomatic folly. But they are not thinking of Vietnam as another instance of man's tragic inability to lay hold of life and to manage it as he wills. Something of our native innocence and optimism is reasserting itself. We seem not to read Vietnam as another sort of classic evidence of man's inability to control violence, his perversity, his ambition, his greed. Rather, we are reading it as the guilt of a few, as the blindness of a nation, you know, caught up in some kind of imperial fancy. And we assume that when we're not caught up in that fancy, when other diplomats are in control, when another party has taken office, there is a way of solving this issue of avoiding similar kinds of follies and of getting on with the business of building a greater America and a greater world. Just a week after the signing of the ceasefire, there appeared on the op-ed page of the Sunday New York Times a kind of lay sermon written by an academic, featured by the editors. If they surmounted it with a picture of a lovely primitive countryside with farmers, you know, busy with their work. The sermon was called "To Try to Dream Again." And the burden of the sermon was simply this: what has not died is our capacity to dream. The vision's splendid. There's a thirst for it. A desire to have someone phrase the great dream which has always, you know, moved the American people to believe that we could transform the richness of the country in which we found ourselves and the openness of the nation which opened itself to us into peace and justice and opportunity and security for all. That dream is coursing within the American soul. How many Americans have said to one another, "Thank God it's over. Now we can get back to the truly serious business. Waste, urban blight, racism, the war on poverty, the health of the nation, the education of our young, the truly real problems. We've given up one war in order to make another war. But this kind time, a war on the domestic front, a war against the ancient scourges of mankind." And paradoxically, at the very moment when many Americans seem to want to pick up again where we think we left off a generation ago, building the great society, a fair deal, a new deal, call it what a politician will, at that very moment, when we find these energies ready to course into a new channel, what do we find? We find ourselves governed by an administration which is not ready to write out programs of hope, which is not ready to present us with a blueprint which will somehow guarantee that this society moves forward to the vision splendid. By one of those strange paradoxes of history, the inauguration of Mr. Nixon for his second term and the signing of the ceasefire took place within a week of each other. And what did Mr. Nixon say at his inauguration? He spoke basically of two things. Both had to do with answers to the question, what will happen in America now that the war is over? The first was a sermon addressed to the American people that we must not simply turn away from our responsibilities in the world, that we must continue to be concerned with our friends and our allies, and he didn't say it, our political and economic advantage on which our freedom rests. We cannot retreat behind the oceans to neo-isolationism. But a second theme was perhaps more interesting because it concerned the mood that America seems to be in now. Instead of offering to the American people a crusade, a domestic crusade against poverty and ignorance and the slums and blight. He said to the American people, now is the time for the government to get out of the business of crusading. Now is the time for America to take less from its citizens in order that its citizens can do more for themselves. Now, Mr. Nixon spoke from an ancient philosophic position. It's the Stoic position. It's the position of Ecclesiastes. It's the position of primitive Christianity. The poor shall always be among us. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. Man toils, but he toils to weariness. We have to begin, he was saying, to accept a vision of life which was, as he would say, realistic, down to earth, to the mud. That many of the problems, many of the tensions which roil in America, the movements which are so much a part of our national fabric, fail, misguide, mislead, because they have set man's eyes on the heavens. They promise too much. They assume that we live close to utopia. And utopia means utopos, no place. There is no such place. All we have is a prickly earth. All we have is a few years. To live is to be frustrated. To live is to be bruised. Now, this is an ancient and honorable philosophic position. I don't want to make more of Mr. Nixon's position than there is in it. But I suggest to you that it is as meaningful as it may be mean-minded. And that we ought to consider not only the immediate implications that of dismantling of programs which we have been accustomed to think of as socially beneficial, but we ought to see if, in fact, he may not be saying something which all of us should take to heart. He does not dream, and that is a negative. We perhaps have dreamt too much. And that also is dangerous. There are dreams and there are dreams. There are visions and there are nightmare dreams. There are grand dreams which have led men to attack the evils of society realistically. And there are daydreams, illusionary dreams, which have led men to suicidal visions. The effort which has not led to constructive results. Yes, Mr. Nixon is right. Our world will not yield simply, easily to our dreams. Utopia is no place. There has never been such a place, and there will never be such a place. Men can talk of consciousness one, or consciousness two, or consciousness three, but they remain men and women, prickly, perverse, unpredictable, given to moments of spontaneous generosity, given to moments of spontaneous violence. No federal program, no governmental program can bring us happiness. We can bring us decent housing. It can bring us opportunity to get proper medical attention. It can provide classrooms for our children. It can provide libraries for our edification, but we must go and read. Our children must go and learn. We must be willing to take the advice of the physician, and we must be willing to maintain the house that is given us in proper working order. There is an individual kind of responsibility which the social dreamer often forgets. He wants government to do it for him, and somehow when government does it for him, he can lead a life which is a life of the dropout, suburbia, whatever it be, a life of indolence, a life of enjoyment, a life of entertainment, and somehow all will be well. And when a country comes as close for its middle class as large a middle class as we have to providing these decencies, then our appetites increase, our palate becomes more sophisticated, it becomes increasingly difficult to satisfy us, and we become increasingly critical of a government which seems not to be able to give us the joys, the happiness, the fulfillment, the salvation, which we think is promised us. Now, insofar as Mr. Nixon is saying, during its era of prosperity, during the abundant 50s and early 60s, Americans began to dream imperial dreams, both at home and abroad. Dreams of great glory, dreams of easy triumph, of our policies and of our programs. Insofar as we expected things to happen to us, America dreamed foolishly. Americans gave up both responsibilities for their own lives and became rather soft in terms of accepting the hard responsibilities of social planning, of moving a little bit ahead, recognizing that we cannot solve any problem all the way, that the solution to any problem leads to other problems. But insofar as Mr. Nixon goes further, and he says essentially that government cannot solve problems, that I will so stratify American society that the monies they now throw into national policies will be shared with the states and shared with the counties and shared with the communities, who will make up their own priorities and solve their own problems. He's a victim of his own illogic. Because if one accepts the vision of man as mean and as selfish and self-involved, then one must accept the sticky fingers of diplomats and politicians and contractors who will keep the money from flowing back to the communities where presumably it would be rightly used. And one overlooks the innate prejudice, self-centeredness of individuals who obviously, where they control power, will use the money for their own benefit and not necessarily for the common good. One needs local concerns. Many of these national programs have failed because they were too large, too grand. At the same time, they moved the nation forward because they broke the control of local parochial narrowness. And they forced on the communities change which the communities would never have forced upon themselves. So here we are, a nation that wants to dream at a time when the leadership of the nation says, watch out for your dreams. Keep your eyes open. Live in a world which can offer you much, but not everything. What shall we say? How shall we face the future? It's not a question of to dream or not to dream. To be alive, to be sane, is to dream. None of us can accept stasis, the world as it is, the status quo, and say, we are satisfied. Perhaps our lives are satisfactory, but who of us is so blind? He does not see the hurt, the injury, the injustice all around him. We need to dream. But we need to dream in a realistic way, with a recognition that we are coming towards perhaps a promised land rather than towards utopia. Let me close by paralleling two images of the dream which occur in our own scripture. There is the vision of paradise, time when every man shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, when justice shall rise up as the waters, where the lion and the lamb shall sit down together, where man will no longer be afraid. This is grand imagery. But the prophets who speak this imagery recognize that this vision will not come until that miraculous time when God will give man a new heart. A heart which is not like our heart, perverse, uncertain, but saintly, always good, unaware of the temptations of sin. And there is another vision of promise, a much more realistic one. Children of Israel are brought out of Egypt and given a law and sent out for the promised land. Now, the promised land isn't the rich delta land of Egypt, and it isn't the rich farming land of the Tigris-Euphrates basin. It's a hilly land. It's a land every one of whose stones is going to have to be picked up by some farmer and put into a hedge so that he can till his soil. It's a land whose forests are going to have to be preserved unless the soil is going to be eroded by the rain. It's going to be a land which is going to have to be carefully nurtured. 6 years you may work it, the seventh year it must lie fallow, else you will burn up the fertility of the land and abuse it. It's a land of thorns and of thistles as well as of milk and of honey. It's a land whose present inhabitants are perverse and will mislead you as well as offer you the gifts of civilization. It's a land, in other words, about which you can dream, in which you can work. But the work is hard work. It's daily responsibility. It's very specific. The duties and responsibilities are clear. And there are some who prefer the grand vision splendid, who want to fold their hands and pray to some deity or some ideology for a time when they can sit under their vine and under their fig tree. And if the world doesn't measure up to this dream right now, they drop out. Or, more likely, frustrated, they become despairing. They deny that there's any possibility. They live only for their own greed and selfishness. Our myth is a rather realistic one. There is a promised land. For the Jews, it was Israel. For mankind, it's this earth. It's a land full of promise and a land full of peril. There are cities that need to be cleaned up. There are rivers and lakes which need to be kept in some kind of purity. There are people who need to be succored and aided. There is poverty, and there is want, and there is civilization. There is misery, and there is education. There is recreation, and there is social disability, a disadvantage. It's not paradise, but it's ours. And it's not impossible to conceive of what we can do each day to make it somewhat better. I doubt that America will ever be quite as innocent as it was in the 1950s and 1960s again. Because I doubt there'll ever be again in the history of the world a time when one nation will control that much of the world's power and the world's wealth. But it would be a tragedy if the spirit of America were now to become mean and embittered, if we would cease to dream, and if each one would simply turn to his own family, to his own advantage, and spend his energies that way. When Joshua was about to lead the children of Israel into the promised land, all he could say to them was simply this: Chazak ve'ematz. Be strong and be of good courage. It's not a very clear prescription, but it's a good one for America in this post-Vietnam era. Amen.